Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
Our guest today is someone who's probably familiar to a lot of our listeners, either through state bar things or social media, but it is attorney, author, and advocate Brian Cuban. Brian, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. And as full disclosure, I think the last appellate brief I wrote was in law school.
Well, the good news is you don't have to be an appellate lawyer to be on our podcast. In fact, I think our guests probably get a little tired of hearing appellate lawyers over and over again. So we try and change it up. And attorney mental health and wellness is one of our kind of side topics that we like to cover a lot. And you're someone who we've wanted to have on for a long time on that.
Well, so, I appreciate it.
Yeah. So for our listeners, I think probably a lot of them are familiar, but those who aren't, or maybe those who don't know your backstory, will you just kind of tell us a little bit about your background, who you are?
Sure. I'm a grad. Well, obviously, my name is Brian Cuban. I'm a graduate of Pitt Law, 1986 grad. I'm not licensed in Pennsylvania anymore. I'm considered retired there. I am licensed in Texas, born and raised in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I'm a baby boomer, middle of three boys. People know my older brother, Mark, and I have a younger brother, Jeff. And went to Penn State before Pitt Law. And after that, I moved to Dallas, where I became basically, quote unquote, you know, like my fiction book, An Ambulance Chaser, doing plaintiff's law after failing the bar three times or two and a half times. Back then, they split it up into parts. You could pass one and fail another and not have to retake it. I have no idea what it's like now. But those failures were absolutely related to drugs and alcohol, you know, failing the bar exam. But finally became a lawyer and became an unethical lawyer, an awful lawyer, every Saul Goodman stereotype there was, except aiding drug cartels is probably something I was engaged in at one point or another. I don't say that as a point of honor, as a badge of honor, but if you open the Texas Bar Journal, which some lawyers ignominiously refer to the pages of shame, at the back, you look at the list of lawyers who are disbarred and suspended, a good portion of those are going to be related to drug or alcohol or other mental or another mental health issue. So during that time in Dallas, I became addicted to cocaine as well as alcohol, developed significant mental health issues, two trips to a psychiatric facility, went to jail, DWI, three failed marriages, one more, I get a free set of steak nod, and a bunch of, you know, just I lost my career as a lawyer. Went to work for my brother. That didn't work out well either because I was just blowing and going, literally. And finally, after my second trip to a psychiatric facility, began my journey forward into recovery. And that was Easter weekend, 2007. But we'll talk about it. But I mean, during that time as a plaintiff litigator, right, you know, it was ridiculous for me to call myself that because I would show up for court high. I was showing up I was doing cocaine in the federal courthouse bathroom, state courthouse, the George Allen courthouse bathroom. I was showing up to hearings under the influence of cocaine or Valium. People might say, well, didn't you know that was wrong? You know, I had addictions. I wasn't stupid. Of course I knew it was wrong. But that's what the definition of addiction, obsessive compulsive drug seeking and use behavior in the face of known and probable consequence, right? Yes, I knew it was wrong. Do lawyers know they can get fired when they're using, you know, when they're off, shut the door, you know, or they're showing up for work drunk or hungover or whatever the issue is? Of course they know that, but it's addiction.
It's beyond your control. Is that what you're getting at?
The disorder itself, the brain disorder in terms of what addiction is and what it isn't. Okay, we get asked, is addiction a choice? Mm-hmm. You hear that all the time, it's addiction a choice. Well, when I was in the bathroom of the Crescent Hotel back when it was called here in Dallas, a bar called Bonash, and I was in the basement of the hotel and I did my first line of cocaine, that was a choice. It was a choice that was predicated on a lot of self-image issues and a lot of other mental health issues I had going on that I needed to feel good about myself and chose a destructive way to do it. But what happened after that really wasn't a choice. The rewiring of my brain that resulted in my needing this, because I very quickly became psychologically dependent on this artificial feeling of looking in the mirror for the first time in my life while I was high and loving myself. But I did my first line of cocaine in that bathroom down at the Crescent Hotel, and I looked in that mirror and said, yeah, baby, at 24 years old or 25, for the first time in my life, I love myself. I had a lot of childhood trauma in my life, at least what I define as childhood trauma. So that feeling became something I incessantly needed. But the cocaine high doesn't last very long, and I use the alcohol to depress the feeling of not loving myself. If I couldn't feel good, I wouldn't feel at all. And these two things, the alcohol and the cocaine, became intertwined and really became this ever-growing snowball rolling forward in my life, just to the giant boulder, this Mount Everest-sized boulder that was taking out everyone and anything around me as I rolled forward. Marriages, family relationships, my career, just leaving a swath of destruction.
When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly, and Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help. As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedious bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond, ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a billion-dollar appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today.
I want to back up for a minute based on something you said, and please don't feel compelled to share too much or anything, but you mentioned childhood trauma, and I think a lot of people at a certain age don't recognize the connection between adverse childhood experiences and trauma and later addiction. But I mean, there's loads of literature and studies on that. I mean, when did you kind of first notice your struggles, or have you just had them your whole life?
That's a great question, because really, to understand my journey through mental health and addiction, you have to understand my childhood. And people can debate the strength of the correlations between childhood trauma or trauma in general and mental health issues. And when we talk about trauma, I'm not talking about the textbook understanding of, say, PTSD that people have. You go to war, this happens or that happens. There are many kinds of trauma, and trauma is unique to the individual. What I view as trauma that impacts my life negatively, another person raised a different way in different social and environmental factors may just shrug that off. That wouldn't bother me, and it wouldn't, whether it's bullying or something like that. So let's take the time machine back to Pittsburgh, PA, growing up in the early 70s, baby boomer. Again, I'm the middle of three boys. Mark was the oldest, Jeff the youngest. And Mark, as the firstborn, was very outgoing, something you might expect, you know, in the Dr. Spock book of childhood development. Outgoing, very entrepreneurial, selling this door to door and that door to door in his teens. I remember our local newspapers went on strike, both of them, and he and his buddies, barely old enough to drive, made their way out to Cleveland, bought the Cleveland Plain Dealer about 200 miles, drove them back to Pittsburgh and sold them in downtown Pittsburgh during rush hour for twice what they paid for.
Wow.
So you kind of knew what he was going to be. He became that.
Yeah.
My younger brother, Jeff, was a good-looking kid, nationally ranked wrestler, jock. The beer parties, the dates, prom, the girlfriend, all the things I associated with love and acceptance and peer acceptance. I was classic middle child syndrome, to the extent people believe that exists, again, in the Dr. Spock hierarchy. I was shy. I was withdrawn. And I internalized anything negative said about me and wore it as who I was, like a skin-tight suit. And I was a heavy kid, trending towards obese. Unfortunately, I also had a very difficult relationship with my mother. And for everyone who listens or watches this podcast, I want to make it clear that I do not blame my mother or my father for anything I went through, for any mental health issue I went through later in my life. Parents do not cause addiction. Parents do not cause eating or disorders. We are people listening to this are going to be, we can have a general understanding. And if you don't, look it up. Cause and correlation are not the same.
Absolutely.
There are trauma and the things that happen in the home can correlate with mental health issues later in life. It'll happen to some people. It won't happen to others. And so that's why we say correlation. It's not going to happen to everyone. There was a lot of fat shaming in my house. I used to come home from school and I would pull open for lunch and I'd pull open the cupboard and I'd pull out the cans of Chef Boyardee, beefaroni, SpaghettiOs. Do they still have that? And I'd take the old style can opener and go, because we didn't have an electronic can opener in the 70s. And we didn't have a microwave, so just stick the spoon in. I wouldn't even heat it up. Just stick the spoon in and gobble it up. And my mom would come home from selling real estate and she would walk into the kitchen, and not all the time, but it happened enough that it was traumatic. And she would say, Brian, if you keep eating that way, you're going to be a fat pig. And these were the things my mother, my grandmother said to my mom. And I have no doubt these were the kind of words that were spoken to my grandmother. My grandparents came from, Jewish grandparents came from Lithuania and struggled, food, come back. And it was the stereotypical Jewish grandparent, eat, eat, eat. My grandmother was also a diagnosed schizophrenic, according to my mother. And my mom and my grandmother had a very verbally and mentally abusive relationship with each other. It was awful. And it was awful to witness as a young boy, what the things they said and did to each other. And so it runs downhill. Fat shaming often runs downhill generationally in families. And my mother was someone at the time who was struggling with her own mental health issues. She'd had a nervous breakdown. She had spent some time in a mental health facility. And I really didn't understand any of this. You know, as a 10-year-old, 11-year-old, when she was gone, I didn't know where she was. And so hearing these things, you grow depressed, right? You're hearing them from your mother.
Sure.
And I began to eat more Chef Boyardee. And I became a bigger Brian and a bigger Brian. And it so often happens when other kids change, when you change for what other kids perceive in the negative in high school, the bullying became worse. I was already bullied to some extent, but it became much worse. Brian, you're a fat pig. Well, you must have talked to my mother, right? Brian this, Brian that. You need to go to Sears, back when Sears was actually a thing, and get a man boob for your bra. And get a bra for your man boobs. Sorry. And I became kind of like the sad clown. Because remember, this is before Al Gore invented the internet. And I didn't have these images of perfection. My images were the people I saw every day. The people who were going to the after-school parties, the people who were going to the football games together, the people who were going to the McDonald's to hang out, in the cars, and just all of the prom kings, the prom queens. And in my mind, they were all thin and good-looking. So these were the images I want to be like. The kids who were getting their first kiss, the kids who were walking down between the lockers, holding hands. And I was experiencing none of that, and in my mind was not deserving of any of that. I wouldn't even bother asking a girl to the prom, because in my mind, she was going to call me a fat pig. So isolated, my time mostly in my bedroom, playing games and doing different things. Isolated very severely. And all the bullying culminated in what I call the day of the gold pants. We have to go back in that time machine to the disco era, around 1976. Where I was a freshman in high school and Saturday Night Fever had just come out, the movie, for those who don't know, John Travolta, and it was really got the disco craze going back then. And so, you know, for all of your Gen Xers and Zers are gonna have to go look up Saturday Night Fever probably. John Travolta starred in this movie and he wore these very tight pants. And Mark was teaching disco in downtown Pittsburgh. So he wore these same types of pants with platform shoes and bell bottoms. One day he walks into my room and holding up these pair of shiny gold satin disco pants. Said, Brian, here, you can have these. I'm buying some new ones. I said, great. And I love my brother and he gave them to me. But Mark wasn't a big guy. They fit him fine. I had to jump up and down, spray the water bottle. My butt looked like 15 cats trying to get out when I finally got in there and stretched them around my gut. And I went to school wearing these pants. My gut hung over. My butt was just bubbly. And the kids made fun of me. Again, I self-deprecated to schluff them off. One day, I'm wearing my shiny gold bell-bottom disco pants, and I'm walking home with this group of kids. Again, in my mind, the popular kids who I kind of hung around, just lurked on the outside of their circle, their clique, hoping that it would be like a fraternity hazing. where they'd say, okay, one day they'd say, okay, Cubes, put their arms around me. That's what they called me. You're one of us now. You can come, right? You can come to the concert. We're going to see Cheap Trick. You can come, for anyone who remembers Cheap Trick. But so we're about a mile from my house. They're making fun. All of a sudden, one of the kids reaches out across and pulls on the zipper, which was already tight and bulging. And it rips just a little bit right down the zipper line. And another kid goes, ooh. And he pulls, and it rips some more and tears. So now my underwear is visible. They were on me like a pack of rabid dogs. They tore my pants off, ripped it into shreds, threw it out in a busy street, cars whizzing by, down to my Fruit of the Loom tidy whities, my Pittsburgh Pirates t-shirt, my Keds three-ring tube socks, and tennis shoes. Right? You remember those? Yeah, you're both still too young to remember the three-ring tube socks.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
And walked on high five, and like they had done the greatest thing ever. I go out in the street, and I pick up the shreds, and I put them over my underwear, and I waddle home, and I'm waddling toward my house, and I might as well have been walking to China. That's how far away my house seemed. And, you know, in this ultimate walk of shame. And I vividly remember the worst part, the absolute killer, just heart-stopping shame, was at the stoplights, standing at the stoplights of a busy road. So I couldn't even run across. If these cars would be stopped looking at me, no one said anything, and they would go on. And I finally get home. The house is empty. I go down into our basement, and it's funny. I talk to a lot of groups, and in Texas, people don't, unless you're from the north, they're like, what's a basement? And you see a basement, right? Yeah. You go downstairs, they're below the house. And I remember there were these blue painted wooden stairs. And with every step, all of a sudden it creaked. I never noticed the creak before, but every step creaked as I walked. And I even tried to tiptoe, but there were these creaks. And that seemed to reverberate like ripples on the water going out to where my father fixed cars in this community called Dormont, about a mile and a half away. He would know my shame. Going out to my brothers, wherever they were, dude, you couldn't stand up for yourself. Going out to my mother selling real estate. See, I told you so, which she wouldn't have said. She loved me dearly, just struggling with her own things. None of them would have. They all would have loved me. That is how deep the shame and trauma was. And I found a wastebasket, and I shoved those shreds, the bottom of the Chef Boyardee ravioli cans and the newspapers and whatever else was in there, thinking that it would hide. I would never speak of this again. And if it hid those shreds, it would hide my shame. And when the garbage man took away the wastebasket, it would take away my shame. But that's not how trauma works. Trauma fed. Threads. Trauma remembers. And trauma has a way of percolating out when we think we've forgotten all about it at the times we least suspect. And it's rarely in a positive way. And when we talk about bright line moments, snapshot, click of our lives, snapshot to trauma, that was obviously a big one. And it was around then that I remember for the first time in my life, looking in the bathroom mirror and seeing something different, not seeing Brian anymore, seeing a fat pig, a monster who would never have a girlfriend, never get married, never have a friend, never be loved by his mother, who, again, loved me dearly, and wasn't worthy of any of it and deserved all of the vitriol that I inflicted on myself, that I was about to inflict it on myself. Because I must punish myself for being a fat pig. That's where it started.
Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, for sure. And it's amazing the level of detail that you can recall about those events and how they impacted you. But I'm sure that's...
Let's talk about that, because we also have to remember, memories, as my psychiatrist, my therapist says all the time when we talk about these things, memories are just memories of memories. We remember feeling, we remember general events, and if we had the hot tub time machine and I was to take that back to Pittsburgh, PA, my hand on, well, you know, eyewitness testimony, right? Did I put my hand on Bible or whatever on a courtroom and say that's exactly the way it happened? Of course not. Of course not, because as we age, our brain fills in detail. That's why we did. That's how we challenge eyewitness testimony.
Right?
Our brain fills in things as we forget things to make up for that. So I believe that's how it happened. But again, beyond a reasonable doubt, of course not.
No one's going to hold you to that standard here, Brian. It's a compelling story regardless. And we do appreciate you sharing that.
So from that, is that kind of when you're addiction journey started, or was that
later?
Well,
it's when I graduated high school with moderate drinking, and I went on to Penn State University, and I was also suffering from bulimia. I believe a lot of people may not realize that guys do get eating disorders, just like females and other genders, you know, whether it's he, she, or they, whatever, however we refer to ourselves. I had suffered from bulimia. I developed bulimia in 1980 or 79 going to 80 as a freshman at Penn State, back when no one was talking about eating disorders for men or women. Mm-hmm. If you remember the singer, the wonderful Golden Boy singer, Karen Carpenter, wonderful drummer and singer, she developed anorexia and passed away from complications in 1983. So this was years before that. And she brought eating disorders into the pre-digital national spotlight, but kind of cemented the stereotype females. It's a female disorder. And that's false. We believe that if you look at the stats, it'll say about 35%. But if you talk to professionals, it could be up to 50% of all those with the eating disorders are male. But only 1 in 10 will seek treatment because of the shame and the stigma and lack of available resources because of the stereotype, shame, and the stigma. So I wanted to touch on that.
Sure.
But I began drinking heavily at Penn State, and it was at Penn State where I would have been first classified as a quote-unquote alcoholic if I had sought help. And for those, the clinical diagnosis is alcohol use disorder. And alcoholic, which is something, it is a legal profession-friendly term. We are a 12-step-friendly profession. For those who don't know, A is the most well-known, but there are other 12-step groups. I was not in any of that at Penn State. And I remember I was going to class drunk. I was drinking alone. Again, I was isolating. I didn't really have any friends that I remember. I would go out at night. And when I turned 21, I would hit the state stores. That's what we have in Pennsylvania. The government still controls the liquor industry and to some extent, the hard liquor industry. And I would buy these little bottles of tequila. And I was wearing, I bought cowboy boots. So I could conceal the tequila. I would go out into the alley where all the bars were at Penn State and State College, and I would down this tequila so I could get drunk before I even walked into the bar, hoping that would allow me to be someone different. But all that would happen in the bar is I would drink more and I wouldn't talk to anyone, and the drinking would just cause me to shrink more into my cocoon. And then I would leave just a complete mess, drunk and just even more self-validated that I was a loser and a monster, not worthy of it, because I couldn't bring myself to talk to anyone and no one talked to me. And I remember my eating disorder, I would go buy a large pizza and binge and purge in the alley, or a 2-pound bag of peanut M&Ms and binge and purge in the alley and not tell anyone. The closest I ever came to any epiphany on maybe I have a drinking problem at Penn State, and there was never an eating disorder epiphany because it just wasn't talked about. But I'd walked into a place, I think it was a hamburger joint. Can't recall the name of it. It might have been White Castle. And I came across a rack of pamphlets that the 12-step groups put out. And it was called the 20 Questions. I don't know if they still do it now. But at that time, they were in the bars and the hamburger joints and things like that. And it was geared towards college students. You pass out, you miss class, you black out. And I'm checking off yes to all of these things mentally. And I thought to myself, I'm just a college student. We all do this, and toss it in the wastebasket. That was it. That was as close as I ever came. I was a criminal justice major at Penn State. I wanted to be a cop. That would have worked out well. I'd have been the first guy in the evidence room trading out the mannitol for the blow, believing the baby laxative, and you know the Cuban connection instead of the French connection. And so I'm sitting in the placement office at Penn State. I was able to do well because it's straight percentage grading. It wasn't a hard major. And I would just pull an all-nighter and pull it together before every exam. And I got decent grades. I had that ability. And I'm sitting in the placement office looking through police officer jobs and these little pamphlets. back before computers. They would mail them, and we would look and see what jobs are available all around the country. And you would, you know, apply for those jobs. And there are two guys sitting next to me. And they're guys I know from the major, obviously. They're from Pittsburgh. And they're talking about taking the law school admission test and going to Pitt Law, applying to Pitt Law, hoping they get into Pitt Law. I close the pamphlet, I inch closer, and I'm listening. And the bells start going off in my head. Not the bells of, I want to be a lawyer, I want to be the next Clarence Darrow, emulate Atticus Finch. The bells of, law school's 3 years. If I go to law school instead of enter the workforce, I can drink, I can binge and purge, and I had also developed exercise bulimia, which is obsessive compulsive exercise for the purpose of offsetting calories. I was running up to 20 miles a day instead of going to class, in addition to the binging and purging and drinking, tremendous strain on my body. And all of these behaviors at that point were like my Linus, if you remember Snoopy, his blanket, right? He had a security blanket. My Linus security blanket of behaviors that no one was going to take away from me. And if I went on a law school, that I would be able to hold on to that security blanket of behaviors for 3 more years. Because my life at that point was not thinking 3 years out that I'm going to be a lawyer, I'm going to go big law, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. I was thinking the tip of my nose, survive, survive, step forward, step forward. And for that reason, and that reason alone, it made perfect sense for me to take the LSAT. That's it.
Wow.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today.
I mean, you're talking about the things that you described that you did. I'm amazed because you hear like the phrase, for example, a functioning alcoholic, and you mentioned how you were able to do well in school. And maybe this is jumping ahead a little bit, but I'm just amazed at how someone can do that.
Let's talk about well as compared to what, okay? And we can talk about this now, right? Barely survived law school, and we'll talk about that. But, you know, well as compared to what standard? There is something I call the Peter Principle of Addiction in the legal profession, and you can probably apply to any other job. The Peter Principle is basically working with, you know, in organizations, forget who coined the term, but you work your way up to your level of incompetence. And theoretically, at that point, we absorb more information, right? We learn the things we need to learn. We increase our knowledge level, and we keep rising in the organization. And I think most people learn that concept in behavioral, you know, organization class or whatever. But when substance use disorder is involved, whether it's alcohol for a lawyer, cocaine, or whatever we're talking about, opioids, what happens is, and I see this anecdotally, there may be studies on this, I don't know, but I doubt it. I think I coined the term in the legal profession. The level of incompetence keeps dropping, where we're, say you're a solo or billing, or you're a big law or boutique, and you're giving a buck for a buck at full throttle, or $1.25. You're working, you're 15 hours a day, and we won't talk about any of that. That's another discussion, right? That leads to many of these things. But let's say in your mind, you're giving it, you're going a buck and a quarter for the dollar. Well, because you're giving it and going 15 hours a day, they're drinking a little more and a little more, and the level of incompetence keeps dropping and dropping, right? And so I can tell myself I am still giving a dollar for a dollar, but now I'm only giving 75 cents for a dollar. And what happens is I don't say, oh, man, this isn't right, because no one else is saying anything to me yet, because I haven't malpracticed anything. I haven't missed a hearing. Oh, my function. I just got that huge $1 million verdict, truck accident verdict, or this verdict. And so everyone's looking and saying, okay. But the reality is I'm only giving 60 cents for a buck. And because no one's saying anything, I'm kneeling under that new threshold, tell myself I'm giving a dollar for a dollar, your principle of addiction. As that threshold keeps lowering and lowering, and finally, malpractice, someone said something, you're giving 50 cents for a buck, client says something, Now career is in jeopardy. Now there's a problem. Now the state, maybe the state bar is involved because you've done something beyond, you know, just malpractice. Or the law, where the, you know, maybe you lose your job or you go into treatment or whatever. But there are consequences. Now there are consequences, whatever they are. The Peter principle of addiction. So I would argue that there's no such thing. When we come to substance use disorder, there's no such thing as a high functioning lawyer. There's only degrees of law.
Interesting. Yeah.
That's where all that was leading, roundabout.
No, that's great. And that's a great context to put that in, because from the outside looking in, it does kind of seem like someone is functioning on a high level, but the reality is they're functioning on a level, but compared to what?
Well, ask them what's going on with their wife and kids. Ask them what's going on in other pillars of a high functioning life, right?
Right.
It may be all you see is this. You know, you only, unless you're the best friend of this person, your colleague, and you're really intertwined with what's going on in the family and things like that. But if you go to SAMHSA and you look at the SAMHSA government website and you look at their definition of recovery, and I would say their name, but I'll probably get it wrong. It's SAMHSA. And it says nothing about sobriety. It says nothing about abstinence. It talks about all these pillars of a good life, work, family, friend, all of these different pillars leading your best life. How is that? What you see is only one pillar. And that person may be expending every ounce of energy he, she, or they have to maintain that one pillar that you see.
Right.
It can be very deceiving.
I do want to talk about recovery a little bit now that you bring that up, whether it's just more generally or your journey. I mean, how do you get to that point, or does someone drag you there?
It's different for everyone. There is an axiom that you can't make someone do what they do, what they're not ready to do. I do believe that everyone on a general level has to be ready to some degree, because unless you're a minor and it's a parental relationship, you can't force someone into treatment. You know, you can force, if someone's a danger to themselves or others, which my brothers tried to do to me, but I was too smart for him. In my first trip to a psychiatric hospital, after I'd nearly killed myself with a weapon, and, you know, that was down in Medical City, Green Oaks, here in Dallas. And you can't make someone do what they're not ready to do. You can lay the roadwork. You can lay the path. And sometimes it's just a question of how much damage they're going to be until they're ready. Believe me, I've working with lawyers and law students, I see it all the time. And the trick becomes, what kind of conversation can you have that is not judgmental, that is not forceful in terms of trying to dictate, triggers that one thing that gets them to, that they grab onto and say to themselves, because they have to say that to themselves, not to you, not to me, that I'm ready. If we could figure that out, we'd all win the Nobel Prize for addiction recovery.
Right.
But it's because whether I'm not an interventionist, I don't have a degree or anything, but I talk to people. I refer people to those with degrees, but I've referred people to interventionists, to this, to treatment, and they've died. And they've died despite everyone. Lawyers you may know, lawyers I know. A lawyer in Pittsburgh just a few months ago, tragic. I went to his house, his family, and we tried to get him an intervention. He's gone just a few months ago. And there's no blueprint. So what can we do? We can be that compassionate community, educate ourselves. So when they are ready, we can help. And how do we do that? Well, obviously, in the legal profession, we have TLAC. Every state has it. Texas Lawyers Association, Texas Lawyers Assistance Practice. I'm on the board and I can't even say it right.
Texas Lawyers.
I wrote off the advisory board. They're going to kill me. And I can't even say it right.
Texas Lawyers Assistance Program.
Thank you. Texas Lawyers Assistance Program. Sorry. And, and you know what's funny is I talk to lawyers who, to this day, I have to explain to them what it is. I've talked to lawyers who, their only exposure to TLAP was maybe there's the law firm they went to, they got the pamphlet, they took a CLE, right? They heard about it in law school, which I'm sure they did. They surely did.
Sure.
But beyond that, they don't have any understanding. I've talked to seasoned lawyers who are afraid to make a call on a colleague because they think it's, it's going to get back to the colleague that they ratted them out. Mm-hmm. It's just not true. It's all confidential. They don't ask who your name is. You can even text. So there are all these stereotypes and stigma around, well, it's an arm of the state bar. I remember when I first started talking, I spoke to the Dallas bar down at Philo, whatever it's called now. And I was talking about TLAP, and after I came out, after it ended, a seasoned litigation attorney comes up to me, pulls me aside and said, Brian, I know what you said, but I'm telling you, it's not confidential. I know. I mean, I just know. Well, how do you know? Well, another guy told me. Well, how does he know? I don't know. I think he knew a guy. So you're a seasoned trial lawyer. You're coming to me with a guy told a guy who told a guy. It's not confidential. That is the definition of stigma.
Absolutely. So
I urge people to learn about TLAP, and I urge lawyers to, it is an act of concern and act of compassion to call TLAP. They may be already be aware of your colleague, your friend, or that mm-hmm. lawyer you saw stagger. It may not even be what you think, right? There could be something else going on. And it's not a judgmental thing to make that call. And so what if I'm wrong and it's some other issue? Well, then you're wrong. But it's mm-hmm. never going to get back to anyone that you were wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, making these calls, and it's an act of compassion, it's an act of empathy, it's an act of concern, and it's also an act of caring about our profession. Because once mm-hmm. it gets to the state bar, that's a different ballgame.
You know, as an attorney or a practitioner, I mean, what are the signs that would inform you to think maybe I do need to make a call?
They're going to be different from anyone. There are certain standards, and it's going to there are certain standard signs, and it's also going to depend. It might where you are. If you're a solo, mm-hmm. you may not have a lot of, except when you're in the courtroom, there may be not a lot of contact, right, with the outside profession, which is another problem. The isolation that causes a lot of these, especially during the pandemic, we've within the solos, drinking tick up, especially for women. There is a study just came out of, done by Patrick Quill, the Californian DC bar, that during the pandemic, drinking ticked up for primarily in the predominant segment of women lawyers, mm-hmm. female lawyers. So lawyers are missing hearing. Lawyers who were kempt are suddenly unkempt. Lawyers, full voicemails, the huge red flag. Suddenly full voicemails. Obviously, there are obvious signs. You're in and the guy's staggering. People get breathalyzed in the courtroom. I know lawyers who have pulled other lawyers that they don't know very well aside and said, I see this. I don't know if the judge sees this. Get help now before it becomes an issue that's out of your control in terms of the state bar. And mm-hmm. I have ethical obligations here. That's a whole nother issue. That's a whole nother issue. So there are really standard signs. And what can happen is a lawyer could talk herself out of it and say, not sure. What if he or she or they yell at me? What if I'm wrong? Well, you don't have to go up to a person and say, you're drinking, they're this or that. Terry Bentley Hill, if you're familiar with Terry, a criminal defense mm-hmm. lawyer, who talks about this often, has what's called the two-ask rule. You should have her on your show. The two-ask rule. Go up to your colleague. How are you doing? Is everything okay? I noticed that you just seem to be, off. You don't have to accuse them of everything. And the response may be, I'm fine. I'm okay. And before that conversation breaks, do you know, the second ask, that if you are struggling and you don't have anyone and you want to come to me, a complete stranger maybe, sometimes those are the best people to go to. You're afraid it'll get back. I'm there for you. And you can even add the third ask if you're truly worried. Tell me truly what's going on. How are you really doing? And that emphasis may, if you think there is something, may really trigger. And what you've done is you've become a cog in a continuum of wellness, where if we all practice this path of empathy and just asking these questions, it may not take hold the first time, but it may take hold the second time, because now they're thinking about it. Now mm-hmm. they're at least thinking about it. It may take hold the third time. And you have laid a path to being ready, because you have to be ready if mm-hmm. they want to walk that path.
So I was just going to say, and you might be the person who finally tips the scale.
Yeah, you might be the person who finally did it. And you may never know that you saved a career, saved a life.
No, I that makes a lot of sense.
Because our profession is in crisis. It is a crisis. Hmm. And while there has been a quantum leap jump in awareness with the ABA's, whatever you think of the ABA, forget that. The legal wellness initiatives they have done are wellness, are wonderful. Mm-hmm. Okay. The protocols they have suggested for firms, the wellness pledge, whether it's big law, small law, boutique law, mid-size, solos, government, corporate, they have laid out great frameworks. Now, does that mean everyone's going to take advantage of it? Does that mean employers are walking the walk? Not necessarily, right? I've spoken at many big law firms, and I'll get an email from an associate saying, well, that's all well and great. They've put me on this. They're having me doing this, this, and this, when it doesn't need to be done this, this, and this fast. And they are not walking the walk they claim.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to deal with that. We have to deal with culture.
Yeah.
And those are just long conversations about, mm-hmm. whether his culture is keeping up, about whether culture is changing in a proportionately to the structures that have been put in place. And I think if you took an anonymous poll, the majority of the profession would say no.
Yeah, totally. That has been my experience as well, because there's still a significant stigma attached to addiction, attached to mental illness. And there's a whole generation and generations of lawyers that say, just toughen up, be tougher.
Absolutely. And you use the perfect term, generation. I hate to be morbid, but it's true. I'm a boomer. A lot of this change isn't going to happen until my generation is out. They're just out of the profession. Yeah, you know, we're moving there, right? So, I mean, I'm not old, but you need to get the until the mastheads are the people who haven't put the bottles, didn't have the bar in their law partners, in their name partner office in the cabinet, who are used to sharing and recovering out loud, who mm-hmm. understand that Alcoholics Anonymous or whatever 12-step isn't the only way to recovery.
Mm-hmm.
Because in our profession, forget it, right? You have to go before it. And it's that way in the criminal justice system as well, especially in Texas, but it's more progressive in other places. Until that happens and we change out these generations, it's going to be lawyer by lawyer.
Yeah.
Well, and even just having these conversations and having people say, hey, I've been through this. This person has been through this and it can get better. If this exists and is a thing, it makes a difference.
And for the crudgemudgeons, I'm going to get emails saying, hey, you're ragging on AA. I'm not. Or 12, you're ragging on 12-step. I got sober in 12-step. It saved my life. I, however, acknowledge that there are many paths to recovery. Sure. And I would like others to acknowledge that as well.
Outside of recovery, I mean, setting aside things that need that level, I mean, what are just some general ways that lawyers who just may be struggling not to that level can build resilience and build help and supports for themselves?
You have to build you. I hate using you. I can tell you what I did.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a therapist. I started finding time, and people may say, well, you don't practice law anymore. It's easy for you. Well, okay. And I will acknowledge that. And that I found even the smallest amount of times for the things that I'm passionate about and for the things that give me joy. I've taken up singing. Don't ask me to sing. I find time for the different, just little things that give me joy and mm-hmm. just even de-emphasizing the things that I felt obligated. I feel I write. Even the things, de-emphasizing even just tiny percentage of the things that don't give me as much and that I can just pull back through a little bit and push that time over to someone else can have a huge impact on my mental health. Does that make sense?
Absolutely does. I completely agree with all of that.
So, I'm not here to tell everyone's life is different. Sure. Marriage, kids, they view their practice differently. It's not my place to insert myself into the life views of other people, but I can say what I did. I slivered the time and redivided them for joy.
Absolutely. Well, and it's telling those stories. It's letting people know that you do need to find time and build resilience, because the practice of law, even if you aren't suffering from any sort of addiction or mental illness or anything, is draining and taxing and difficult and stressful.
And there seemed to be this notion that we have to fail to build resilience. It is just not true. We can build resilience through the stories of others and learning from others. It's why I absolutely cringe when I see the every LinkedIn post in the world, right? The seven habits of mentally strong people. Does that mean if you don't engage in those, you're mentally weak? There's no, in my mind, and this is again the crudgemudgeon of the old lawyer, there are levels of resilience that we can build. Everyone has a different level of resilience. Resilience can be built and resilience can be learned. And it can be learned without having to go through trauma.
Just briefly, you did mention LinkedIn. You're a social media presence, and I know that you use it, but you also have a lot of criticisms of it. I mean, how do you kind of navigate that, especially dealing in recovery and kind of maintaining a healthy balance?
I'm not aware of any specific mental health criticism. I've criticized the LinkedIn police who troll anyone who posts anything other than marketing, SEO, or whatever, right? Marketers and SEO, I love you. I'm saying the people who believe they have to be, who have to police LinkedIn, and anytime someone posts about mental health, they're on them. That's not for this. Shut up. Just shut up. Mind your own freaking business, right? And I block them. That's what the block is for. Mm-hmm. Now you don't have to see my post. But I have criticism there of LinkedIn.
I've seen you engage with people on Twitter. And I think you do a good job of calling people out sometimes for insensitive comments and bad approaches to things, which I appreciate from you.
Yeah, you do. And my view is just my view. Mm-hmm. You know, 10 people have 10 different views, but we do have things called stigma. We do have something called stigma that is evidence-based. There are studies and people, blah, blah, blah. There are studies that if you use the word addict, it has a shaming effect. There are studies that if you use the word cokehead, as I get called all the time on Twitter, not so much anymore, but if something goes viral and all the trolls come in, right? Yeah, you're a cokehead and this and that, mm-hmm. whatever. I say, no, it was powdered cocaine. The stigma around crack, right? That's another story, how that happened racially. And so a lot of it I've learned to roll off me. Plus, because of my last name, if I let it just comes in more than maybe some others. Sure. So if I let it bother me, you know, I'd be back at Green Oaks for my third time.
Well, you mentioned when we were talking about resilience and joy, something that I want to cover here kind of in our last few minutes, which is you're an author, both of nonfiction, kind of talking about your journey, but more recently is fiction. How'd you make that transition into writing fiction? I think it's pretty cool.
I wrote my first two books, The Shattered Image on Body Image and Eating Disorders, which probably can't find anywhere. And then The Addicted Lawyer, which is a much more popular book within the legal profession and elsewhere. And how many times can you tell your own story? I love to write. I just can't do it again. Mm-hmm. I mean, what am I going to talk about? You know, the 7 lessons I've learned from The Addicted Lawyer, right? The 10 lessons, the addicted lawyer.
Sounds like a LinkedIn post.
Yeah, so I'm going to repurpose what I've had out there twice. And I'm just not going to do that. Because that's not the joy of writing. That's feeling like I have to press something out for content. The joy of writing is creative for me. And so, okay, I had a dream. Here's how the ambulance chaser in our last few months came about. Okay. I've been having this reoccurring dream, and it's dark. It is dark. So if you're triggered by dark dreams, shut down the volume. I had this reoccurring dream about growing up in Pittsburgh with one of my childhood friends, and we're throwing dead bodies into a bonfire. I don't know why we're throwing them in, but we're throwing them in, and they're naked, and they're crackling, this giant kind of Texas A&M style bonfire. And sorry, Texas A&M.
I'm not an Aggie. No Aggies here. So, yeah.
No, but I'm just giving people an idea of the bonfire.
Sure, sure. Right.
That's what writers do, right? We do these similes and things. And so you can envision it. And so their eyes are staring back at me like these 8-ball cracked eyes. They're bulging. And then all of a sudden, the dream shifts to Brian as an adult. And I wake up with this terrified feeling in my stomach, wake up from the dream, wondering if I've murdered anyone and why I haven't been arrested. And so it went through many ideations, but skeletons in the closet, time passes, caught as an adult. The skeleton closet's open as an adult. There are not a new concept in fiction and thriller writing, but Here's something I tell every fiction writer, beginning fiction writer. There are only about 12, and some people will say 12, some people will say 8 plots in the world. Anything you watch, anything, whether it's TV, whether it's you read it, no matter what genre, it is going to be a variation of one of these plots. You know, romance has theirs, thrillers has theirs, whether it's Grisham or Don Winslow. And almost like many of the hero's journey, if you've ever heard of that. Everything you watch, everything you consume along the in the fiction realm is going to be one of these. So you're not going to think up anything new. So for Jason, it's a lawyer who was involved in a crime. It wasn't that crime, but involved in a crime with a high school classmate 30 years prior. This girl is subsequently murdered and the body's discovered. Now he's in his career and he's afraid when it comes out that he was involved, it's going to bring him down. His wife's the district attorney. You know, he has a son, and it's going to bring him down. What does he do? And he's ultimately arrested for it. Old crime coming back to haunt new adult. Nothing new. The only thing that is new in fiction writings is great characters, great, wonderful characters, interesting situations. You may get the plots are all the same, but you can have interesting situation and twists. And those are the new things to focus on, because you're not going to think of a new plot.
I really enjoyed it. I read it when it came out last year. So I'll put my plug in for what that's worth, that it's, well, it's worth reading.
When we finish, I'll give you an example. Thank you. I'll give you an example. I'm writing a book called The Body Brokers. That's my second novel that I'm finishing up. And it is not about stealing kidneys. It is about a murder that happens within the addiction community. The protagonist, Jason, the girl he is dating, it overdoses. And her roommate go on this quest to solve, to prove her overdose was not accidental. And it takes them into the world of addiction body brokering. So, and what body brokering is how treatment facilities just bring in bodies. They don't really try to help anyone. They just bring in bodies, put them through 30 days, the insurance runs out, put them back out on the street to overdose and die, or go back to the addiction, bring in another body to fill the bed, bill the insurance company. That is the general nature of body brokering. And I get one of my guys looking at my manuscript. Hey, did you know that the guy, Michael Williams, the guy who played Omar on The Wire, he had this movie, The Body Brokers. It's about this. And I said, yeah, mine's different. There's nothing new.
So
just get used to that.
So may we see The Body Brokers out?
For sure next year. For sure next year. I'm finishing it up as we speak.
I want to ask you just, that's quite a transition. You having written your own sort of recovery slanted books, I assume you kind of found your groove and what worked for you as a writer in terms of being able to produce a book, because that's a big, big job.
It was a learning process. Writing memoir is not the same as writing fiction. I am fortunate to have a very good mentor who lives out in California, and she's a very respected novelist, and she doesn't tell me what I want to hear. She'll tell me if something sucks. And it took me I was working on the ambulance chaser and sending her stuff. And she was saying, this is awful. And saying this to be, and here's why it's awful. And it was because I didn't understand how to write fiction. And I didn't understand that you have to read other fiction. I thought because I wrote a memoir, I can just go boom, 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 right? No, I had to stop. And I began reading everything. I began reading thrillers, legal thrillers, dramas. I began reading romantic novels, first person, third person, and all of these things, and BIPOC, and figuring out what works as a voice, figuring out what's bad, what I wouldn't do, and figuring out my voice. And I went through all of these processes to learn the art of writing fiction. In my opinion, it is impossible to learn to write fiction unless you read a lot of fiction. And before I started, I huffed that off. People said that to me. And now I believe it with every bone in my body. It is impossible to learn how to write fiction, or it's not going to be good fiction. It's not going to be technically good fiction. Yeah. And then you have to do it. And then you have to get critiqued. And you have to get critiqued by people who are going to pardon it, tell you you suck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it may not be that brute, and it may not be that on the nose, right? But the worst mistake writers can make is sending their manuscript to beta reader. The worst mistake novice fiction writers can make is to send out their manuscript to people that are going to just going to tell them how great they are. You need those people to tell you you suck and why, right? Obviously, just you suck isn't helpful. If you want that, send it to a literary agent. They'll tell you you suck when you have to get into the query process.
Wow.
Another conversation. They'll tell you you suck in an email, two words, and that's it.
Well, this is good advice for practicing lawyers, too.
Yeah, this sounds a lot like legal writing and learning to be a legal writer as well. You know?
Be critical, not a jerk, right? Mm-hmm. I say you suck to make a point, but it's not helpful to say to leave it there. You got to lay the groundwork for someone to get better.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Constructive criticism.
That's right. Just leaving it at suck isn't constructive.
That's you use but that for the other side's briefing, not yours.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I do that. And I send my manuscript out to people, just like, you know, to people who have intimate knowledge of a particular subject area. You may do that for legal briefs, for appellate briefs. I send them out to, well, you do your own research, but if I have a cop, I'll send it out to a cop.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is this technically correct? Because you have what's known as author authenticity, right? I have to know what is correct. I have to know what can happen, what always happens, or what never happens.
Mm-hmm.
And for what never happens in terms of technical things could hurt your author authenticity. Sure. So if I have a female doctor, I'll send it out to a female doctor because I need to be sure I'm not usurping, or if it's a black doctor or another person of color doctor, what reference could I possibly have for that? So you have your targeted readers to make sure that you get it right.
Makes sense.
Agreed. Well, Brian, one thing I can say, I think I can speak for Jody on this too, is we certainly admire your courage in sharing your journey. For many years, you know, we've both followed you and you've been very outspoken about your journey and not shy at all about helping others through the experiences that you went through yourself. And so we'll speak as lawyers and on behalf of the legal profession too, to say thank you. It's a direct tie-in to some other conversations we've had on this show about TLAP specifically and about substance abuse and alcohol abuse and the things that lawyers do that are very, very self-destructive, but where they can't always help themselves. And at least not without reaching that point that you described, where that point of acceptance where it's, you've got to say, yes, I need help. So thank you for that. And thank you for talking through it with us. And we're also interested in your career as a writer and certainly want to.
Well, you're now on my email list, whether you like it or not.
That's great. I think I may have already been before, but that's fine.
So no, I'll be happy to see it when it comes and look forward to reading it. So, but it's our tradition on our show to leave each interview with an opportunity for the guest to offer a tip or a war story to our audience. So with that in mind, do you have something that you'd like to say?
Absolutely. So let's take that Hofstede time machine back to June of 2006. The Dallas Mavericks are going to the NBA championship for the first time. They're playing the Miami Heat. And I hadn't gone into recovery yet. As you might expect, also, I was going to get some pretty good seats for those games. I also had the opportunity to get a couple tickets for friends. I called up my brother, and this is when we had paper tickets. I called up my brother. He said, sure, Bri, come on over. And I got the tickets. You think I gave them to my friends? You probably think I sold them on eBay for some astronomical amount, right? Thinking like a lawyer. I didn't do that either because that would be disrespectful to Mark, to the team, to myself. I took those two tickets and traded them to my cocaine dealer for $1,000 in cocaine. Oh. Selling them on eBay was disrespectful, but trading them to my cocaine dealer, perfectly acceptable. All the mind works in addiction. So my dealer shows up at my house. I was high class. He delivered. I give him the two tickets, gives me this giant bag of cocaine. I run up to my home office, dump it out on my desk like I have here, like I'm Scarface. I wanted to go rub my nose in it. And I line it out, roll up a dollar bill. And cocaine users, guys, we're kind of an ironic bunch, especially during pandemic times. You use the Purell, you wash your hands, but we'll stick a dollar bill up our nose that's been used by God knows who and has God knows what on it. Go figure. But cocaine, I had long stopped giving me the feeling of self-love and acceptance, and now it was paranoia. Do I hear the cops outside? They weren't out there, but I'm paranoid. I hide the cocaine. I drive to a Home Depot where I buy electrical faceplate outlets, a drill, and a saw. I drive back to my house and I take the drill and saw. I go and take the drill and I create these fake electrical outlets in all the in the drywall and all the rooms in my house. I put the cocaine in smaller Ziploc baggies, slap it behind the drywall, seal it up, thinking I'm the smartest lawyer ever. Like the DEA, the cops, and the drug dogs have never thought of that before, right? So I did some more. I lined out some more, and again, just pain and chain and paranoia again. Go back to those electrical outlets, take it all back out again, go to my master bathroom and flush it down the toilet. Now it's $900 worth of cocaine. I flush down $900 worth. I get up the next morning, and I'm thinking, wait a minute. Did I flush my blow down the toilet? I'm an idiot. Who does that? There's another game tonight, too. I call up my brother again. I get two more tickets for the game. Gosh. I call up my dealer. He shows up at my house. He said, dude, you did it all last night? I said, I didn't want to tell him I flushed it down the toilet like a moron. I said, yes, I did it all. Give me more. Okay, here you go. Rinse, wash, repeat. Back up to my home office. Line it out. Sniff, sniff. Get paranoid. Hide it behind the electrical outlets again. Then maybe an hour and a half later, take it back out, go to that same bathroom again, drop to my knees like I'd done so many times, praying or hoping for someone or something, take away my shame and my pain, and flush it down the toilet again the second night in a row.
Wow.
They say when Dallas flushes, it runs downhill to Houston. So some people in Houston had a little hop in their step those two nights. Yeah, that was a common thing when the Mavs and Houston were a big rivalry.
Yeah.
When we played in a playoff. And the morning news would always run the story about how the wastewater runs downhill to Houston.
That's awesome. Wow. That's a good one, Brian. Thanks for sharing. It gives us a little insight into the mind, the mindset you must have been in at the time.
Oh, there are many. Gosh. I mean, going to hearings, just smashed and on cocaine. Yes, motion denied. I mean, and I don't say that as badge of honor. And some of your readers are like, how is this guy's name not in the back of the Texas Bar Journal, right? Never sparred or suspended. I wasn't disbarred, never suspended, but it wasn't for a lack of trying.
Wow.
And I'll leave it with that.
Well, we're really grateful that you shared all this and spent this time with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.